As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Ora Ogunbiyi.
And I'm Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Today, Republican primaries begin in Florida, and they will look pretty different from those of cycles past. Our deputy editor takes a road trip down south to find out why the Sunshine State has swung so decisively to the right.
And we treat you to one of our Economist Reads, our collection of the essential books on all kinds of topics. Today, what to read to understand why God seems so preoccupied with the pleasures of the flesh. But first, back in 2016, Japan's central bank made a daring move.
The Bank of Japan has cut interest rates to minus 0.1% from plus 0.1%. The surprise move to negative rates is to combat deflation.
Rates had been going down since 2007, but that move below zero was, as in other countries, a bit experimental. It made money cheap, and along with other measures in the policy laboratory, it was supposed to heat up the economy and counter chronic deflation. Well, there may finally be an outcome to the experiment. Wages are broadly on the way up, and deflation has turned into inflation in what the central bank predicts will be a sustainable and stable manner. So it's time to take off the lab coat.
The world's biggest experiment in unconventional monetary policy has come to an end.
Noah Snyder is our Tokyo bureau chief.
First and foremost, the bank has done away with negative interest rates, which it instituted first in 2016. It's gone for its first rate hike, in fact, since 2007. So they've gone from an overnight policy rate of negative 0.1% to one of between 0 and 0.1%. They've also stopped buying exchange-traded funds, so Japanese assets, and done away with yield curve control, which is essentially a tool to cap long-term bond yields.
So let's wind back to why it is Japan ended up with this unusual set of policies.
It's a great and important question, Jason. I mean, I think it's worth doing a little capsule history of the Japanese economy here. I mean, we go back to start to the 1980s when Japan's economy was booming. Japan was on the verge of, it seemed like, taking over the world. And then a huge asset bubble burst. And that left Japan's economy sliding into deflation in the 1990s. A bunch of big financial institutions went under, and the economy really struggled to regain its balance. It entered essentially a long period of kind of stagnation, of deflation and low inflation. And the Bank of Japan was relatively cautious when it came to experimenting with new policy tools, though they were the first central bank in the post-war era to implement quantitative easing, for example, between 2001 and 2006. But the wild stuff really began under Kuroda Haruhiko, who took over as Bank of Japan's governor in 2013. And he came in promising to unleash what he called a bazooka of stimulus. The bank adopted a 2% inflation target. It began buying up tons of government bonds and issuing aggressive forward guidance. And that eventually then led down the road towards negative interest rates and this YCC, this yield curve control, to mitigate some of the effects. But as all of that was happening, deflation still remained a real problem. Japan's economy never quite got up to that target Kuroda was aiming for.
So what's changed here? The suggestion that rates should go positive now seems to suggest that those targets are being met?
That's right, Jason. Japan's key inflation indicator has been above the bank's 2% target for 22 months now. You know, in many ways, the pandemic and the war in Ukraine and the impact those had on global supply chains, they did what Kuroda's bazooka never really could and set Japan's inflation expectations on a new track. Those rising import costs have filtered through and spread to the domestic economy as well. And finally, last week, we got kind of the missing piece of the picture, which was an indication that wage growth in Japan was going to be commensurate or even higher than inflation itself. So that kind of gave the Bank of Japan confidence that inflation is embedded enough and that the economy is in a strong enough place to remove some of these kind of emergency extreme measures that were implemented over the past decade.
So this is a really big deal. It's a sort of decadal change then in Japan's economy.
Yes and no. It's definitely huge, symbolically speaking. I mean, it really does mark the end of an era for Japan's monetary policy, for global monetary policy, and certainly for Japan's economy. But that said, for such a momentous decision, the short-term impact is likely to be pretty limited. In part, that's because the BOJ has been signaling and indicating its intentions ahead of time, meaning that markets have largely priced in the move. There's some concern that global capital flows could be affected by this, but they're unlikely to shift drastically because Japanese rates won't be very high relative to the rest of the world in any case. Even at home, the change to the key policy rate isn't likely to have a huge effect because under the old framework, there was in fact a complicated system of tiering of accounts and really the share of funds that were subject to those negative rates was minimal. So the impact is going to be less extreme than perhaps the headlines would suggest.
Well, but this is the first move into positive territory, right? If there are more rises, then maybe the capital flows change and investments change, the number of accounts that are subject to juicy rates change, no?
That's true. And it all depends on where the Bank of Japan goes from here. And I think they've been very clear, certainly in their comments today and in the statement released today, that they're not planning to embark on a swift rate hike cycle. This is more about normalizing the framework, normalizing the policy tools in Japan, rather than rushing to sort of hike rates to clamp down inflation, as we've seen elsewhere in the world. So they are really doing a delicate dance. They don't want to snuff out this nascent growth in prices and wages. They don't want to slow down the economy too much. In fact, growth is pretty anemic in Japan these days. So I don't expect that we're going to see big rate hikes going forward. You know, many economists expect that ultimately the rates will settle at 0.5% or probably even lower than that.
And the last time we spoke to you about Japan's economy, you mentioned that there had been some false starts in past decades. I suppose the delicate dance you describe is policymakers trying not to shoot themselves in the foot here.
Exactly. And it's definitely going to be a tricky dance to continue to execute without slipping up. There are big risks in the coming months as this normalization process continues. One is external, which is namely that a slowdown in America or in China, which are Japan's two biggest trading partners, could weigh on Japan's own economy. Another set of risks come from within Japan itself. In the long run, of course, interest payments on Japan's big pile of government debt will rise, and policymakers are going to have to do something about that. More immediately, the financial system, while it looks sound, weak spots could emerge as the policies change and rates rise. Most worryingly, you could see a slip backwards in terms of wages and prices. The BOJ is taking a little bit of a gamble in moving when it is now. In fact, there were two dovish members on the board who voted against this move, saying that it was just a bit too early to say for sure whether this quote-unquote virtuous cycle of wage and price growth is really taking hold. And I think for that trend to continue in the way the BOJ would like to see in the coming years, Japan needs to undertake measures to raise productivity, to boost the potential growth rate, to really work on the supply side of its economy. And, you know, I think if there's any single lesson from Japan's long experiment in unconventional monetary policy, it's that there's really a limit to what central banks can do. And for the next phase, policymakers, politicians, other parts of the government and Japan's economy are going to have to take the lead.
Noah, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we head to my home state of Florida, a little reminder about our survey. We've made some changes to our shows and want to know what you reckon, particularly if you listen to us here on The Intelligence but haven't subscribed to our new premium service, Economist Podcasts Plus. Do me, do us a favor and click the link in the show notes. Won't take a sec. Now, road trip!
Lunatics is a comic novel published in 2012 by two American authors, Dave Barry and Alan Zweibel. The idea is they wrote alternate chapters, making each one more preposterous than the previous one.
Robert Guest is a deputy editor at The Economist. And ahead of Florida's Republican primary today, he took a bit of a road trip through the state to understand more about what exactly is on voters' minds.
So it starts with two suburban dads disagreeing over something really mundane, an offside call at a schoolgirl's soccer game. And then it just explodes. And before long, the dads have inadvertently hijacked a cruise ship full of nudists and overthrown the governments of more than one country. But it's not until chapter 52 that Donald Trump tries to become president of the United States. Now, when I was in Florida, I sat down with Dave Barry and asked him about that choice.
I can't remember which of us decided to make Donald Trump a serious presidential candidate, but we both thought it was just really hilarious. There was, like, no one could top that for just sheer ridiculousness.
Sometimes comedy can't compete with reality. I went to the Sunshine State, Donald Trump's home state, to find out how the Republican Party has done so well in what used to be a swing state.
But Robert, Florida has become a bit of a meme in itself, right? It's known for being home to the ridiculous. How did the state earn this reputation?
Well, Florida is a big mix of all kinds of things. And, you know, you've got the people doing crazy things to attract tourists. You've got the memes about Florida Man doing silly things with alligators and pythons. But the serious point about Florida is it's kind of like America on steroids. It's a place that people move to improve their lives. So nearly two-thirds of Floridians moved there from somewhere else. About a fifth were born abroad. And they come for a lot of reasons, from the weather to the absence of a state income tax. And that was supercharged during the pandemic. So Florida had some of the loosest lockdown policies in the United States. And that attracted lots of people who didn't want to have their kids shut out of school or not being able to run their businesses. Some of these ideas came up in my conversation with Dave Barry.
They came here because they thought it was better here than somewhere else.
Yeah.
And they don't want that to change, which is like, you know, a fundamentally conservative position. I've been here 38 years. There's no state pride at all in this state. You know, not like Texas or Alabama or even New York where, you know, people are proud of it. So when people say, so Floridians, oh God, Florida, your state is crazy, we all go, yeah, it is.
Is that crazy state that Dave described something that you witnessed while you were there?
It's a little bit crazy. I mean, I drove past the place in Florida where they have mermaid impersonators who are state employees. But mostly I met normal people trying to live their lives and trying to make sense of politics without necessarily paying that much attention to it. So I went to one community in particular, in Moorhaven. It's a small town in central Florida. It's the seat of Glades County. It's a quiet place, older residents trundling around on golf carts. And one of the largest local employers is a prison. It's the Florida county where Democrats have lost the most ground since 2012. Barack Obama lost it by 19 percentage points back then. And just 8 years later, Joe Biden lost it by a stunning 46 points.
And what did you hear from the voters that you met?
I talked to Eileen Arenas, who runs a cafe near the highway that bisects Moorhaven. She'd escaped from Cuba in 2005 when she was 18. And she moved to Miami and worked in a Subway sandwich shop for about 6 years. But she says she wanted more. She said she doesn't really watch the news because it's too gloomy. But when I asked her how she felt about Trump, she called him a badass.
I don't know a lot of politics, you know. But I know that I saw a change when he was our president. And I saw the change now, too. You know, everything is more difficult. People are like...
So the change when he was the president was what?
Let's say, for example, gasoline. It was cheaper. I think people had more opportunity to, I don't know, to grow up.
Republicans have generally done well with Cuban voters in Florida, and that's partly because some Democrats speak warmly about socialism. They're probably thinking of Nordic-style welfare states when they say that, but to someone who's just escaped from Venezuela or Cuba, the word socialism conjures up images of shortages, hyperinflation, secret police, and being tortured for dissenting. It's a really toxic word, and it turns them off. The other Republicans in town just liked Donald Trump and felt that he told the truth and cared about people like them.
Now, what about the Democrats? You mentioned earlier that they've lost lots of ground in Florida, but did you meet any?
In Moorhaven itself, I only met one Democrat. It's a middle-class woman who insisted on anonymity because she didn't want to upset all the people that she has to interact with. And she said she was just completely baffled as to how anyone could be taken in by Trump. She said, you know, why do the evangelicals like him? He's cheated on all his wives. He's admitted to being a sexual predator and a completely self-absorbed sociopath. She thought her neighbors were living in a fantasy world where Trump cares about people like them and climate change is a myth. I also met quite a few people who used to be Democrats but had shifted, had fallen out of love with the party. A guy named Daniel Crow I found assembling bikes on his front lawn, who said he used to vote Democrat, but he now backs Trump because he says Trump says some stupid shit, but he felt that he stands for the people and he's going to bring back the jobs from China.
So the reason that we're talking about this today is that it is the Republican primary in Florida. Now, Donald Trump already has the nomination clinched, of course, but what about November?
I think Trump is going to win Florida handily this year. You know, the Trump voters were passionate and probably going to turn out. The Biden voters, they all said, oh, God, well, you know, he's all right, but he's old and he's dull. And, you know, they were just not keen to get out there and vote. And the Democrats in the state point to what happened in the governor's race in 2022 when the Republican candidate was Ron DeSantis, who was, you know, outspoken culture warrior. And the Democrats put up a guy called Charlie Crist, who's, you know, there's nothing wrong with him, but he's old. Everyone was bored of him. And only half the Democrats bothered to show up to vote, whereas two-thirds of the Republicans did. Ron DeSantis was re-elected by nearly 20 percentage points.
We reject woke ideology. We fight the woke in the legislature. We fight the woke in the schools. We fight the woke in the corporations. We will never, ever surrender to the woke mob. Florida is where woke goes to die.
In his victory speech, DeSantis said, we not only won an election, but we redrew the political map.
And is that true? Have the Republicans redrawn Florida's political map?
Yes, in short. Florida used to be, in national presidential elections, it was a bellwether state. It voted for the winning candidate 21 times out of 23 between 1928 and 2016. In 2000, famously, a mere 537 votes, not counting the hanging chads in Florida, put George W. Bush in the White House. Barack Obama narrowly carried the state in 2012, but now it's taken a sharp shift to the right, and it's not even considered very competitive this year. So if there's a lesson I took away from Florida, is that enthusiasm matters. And a lot of Trump voters are very enthusiastic about Donald Trump, even if half the country hates him. Democratic voters are not that enthusiastic about Joe Biden. and that could cause them problems in November.
Robert, thank you so much for your time.
Ore, thanks very much.
It's a difficult question. Why does God care so much about sex?
Gloria in excelsis Deo.
Catherine Nixie is a Britain correspondent for The Economist.
It's not an obvious obsession. Imagine it. You are an omnipotent, omniscient deity. You've created not only the world and everything in it, but also the sky, the stars, the heavens, and, for that matter, Tuesdays. So what do you spend your time worrying about? Well, to judge by many of today's most heated ecclesiastical arguments, you spend your time worrying about what men do with other men in their bedrooms, and just occasionally, though much less often, what women do with other women. It's a tricky time for Christianity. Many Catholics across the world are currently cross because Pope Francis has modernised the Church's attitude towards blessings for same-sex couples. Although I would read that word modernised with caution. The change appeared in a document bearing the Latin title Fiducia Supplicans and was itself clarifying a note called Responsum ad Dubium. Modern is a relative term in the Catholic Church. So why does God care so much about sex? It's a good question. And it's one that's baffled observers of Christianity for 2,000 years. Before he came along, European gods didn't care much about this sort of stuff. The chief problem that Roman and Greek deities had with sex was when they couldn't get enough of it. When Christianity turned up, classical intellectuals professed themselves completely baffled by its restless, shamelessly curious new deity. A nuisance, they thought, who pruriently watched men's every act and then judged it. Surely, they argued, a god had better things to do. As the subsequent 2,000 years of history showed, he did not. Here are six books that help understand why.
The Poems by Catullus.
If you want to understand what difference Christianity made to sex, then you need to know what sex was like before Christianity, and there's few better places to start than the sinewy, sensual poems of the Roman author Catullus, who wrote passionate, often quite rude, poems, often to his lover Lesbia. But then again, you could also read the Roman author Ovid, who wrote a guide to lovemaking called The Art of Love, or you could also read Sappho, the Greek poetess and original lesbian, or you could read Martial, or, to be honest, the list is quite long.
The Confessions by St. Augustine.
This probably has one of antiquity's most famous lines in it. Grant me chastity, but not yet. It's a famously racy book about early Christianity, which is to say it's not really very racy at all. In it, St. Augustine frets about pretty much anything remotely sexual that happens to him, from a trip to the bathhouse with his father where he has to take his clothes off, to the fleshpots of Carthage, which are a bit more racy. But, as usual, a cause of great angst to the young Augustine.
God, A Human History by Reza Aslan.
According to the Lord's Prayer, things should happen on earth as it is in heaven. In this book by Reza Aslan, he says, bunkum. In fact, Aslan argues, the truth is much closer to the reverse. Things happen in heaven as they happen on earth. So humans create societies and then they cook up heavens to match them. This is as true for politics, so democratic ancient societies had squabbling democratic heavens, while autocratic societies had autocratic deities, as it is for sexual politics. An apotheosis of angst is what you're seeing when God cares about sex.
God, An Anatomy by Francesca Stavrakopoulou.
Christians argue that God is sexless, bodiless, and lustless. Nonsense, says the British biblical scholar Francesca Stavrakopoulou. On the contrary, if you read the Old Testament carefully, then it becomes very clear that God used to have a massive body and other things, and really quite a good time of it. Suffice to say, after reading this, you will never look at a rainbow in the same way again.
Demons and the Making of the Monk by David Brackey.
As every good Christian knows, there are seven deadly sins. Except they're wrong. The seven deadly sins were not always deadly sins. Originally, they were deadly demons. And also originally, there were eight of them, not seven. The eighth, which was listlessness, appositely dropped by the wayside. Here, Brack explains how the fear of these demonic presences shaped the 4th century Christian mind, and how that monkish mind then went on to shape the rest of Europe for the next millennium.
The Body and Society by Peter Brown.
When modern minds look at the ancient world, they tend to think, why not? Why not be like Catullus and just have sex? Well, as Peter Brown points out in this sweeping history, it was all right for Catullus, but what about all the people he was having sex with? It often wasn't quite as much fun for them. Slaves, women, less powerful people in the ancient world. So in this book, he points out that a better question than why not have sex was, for many people, why have it?
Head over to our website and look for the Economist Reads section. You'll find more of our correspondents' recommendations on a wide variety of subjects, from cybersecurity to El Salvador. I even wrote one about cocktails that was really very popular. Click the link in the show notes to find out more. That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.